Hey, Kelsey, we gotta record another commercial. It's that time of year.
Can we just reuse the one from last year, you think?
Well, we can't because, like, Giving Tuesday's on a different day this year.
Just change the date.
Oh, yeah. Good call. Okay. Hey, Kelsey. We do a lot of work here at the Video Game History Foundation, traveling to meet old game developers, maintaining our library, and making cool content. But how do we pay for all this?
Well, Frank, we're a publicly funded charity. All of the work that we do is made possible through generous donations from video game fans all around the world.
Hey, that sounds just like our listeners. From Giving Tuesday, November 29th through the end of this year, we'll be fundraising to help make the work we do possible. Our generous sponsors are even matching donations dollar for dollar, so your impact is doubled.
So head on over to gamehistory.org/donate and give what you can. Every dollar helps.
Let's save video game history together. Okay, back to the show. I don't think we need to do another take.
No, I think that was good. All right, I'm stopping it. Welcome to episode number 98 of the Video Game History Hour, presented by the Video Game History Foundation. Every episode, we bring in an expert guest, someone who's done their research or lived through it and has an interesting story from video game history to tell. My name is Kelsey Lewin. I am the co-director of the Video Game History Foundation, and I'm here, as always, with Frank Cifaldi, the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation.
And our guest today is video game historian and archivist Dylan Mansfield. Dylan's here today to talk to us about an odd piece of Sega history, namely a game called The Sacred Pools, a mid-90s FMV game with adult themes that I'd never heard of before now, and until recently was considered lost. Dylan, welcome to the Video Game History Hour. So glad to have you here.
Hey, it's great to be here. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
You know, I'd describe you, if someone were to ask me, like, what's Dylan's deal? I'd say you're someone who specializes in researching unreleased video games, kind of specifically in this sphere. Is that fair?
Yeah, I would say so. I should ask, is this the first episode of the podcast that's specifically about like a prototype release or like an unreleased game being released?
That's a great question that we should know the answer to.
We should totally know.
I feel like the answer is no, but I actually can't come up with another one.
We had Raven Simone.
Oh, that's true. And we've also had a couple. We had like the Work Boy, a couple of unreleased like peripheral slash games as well. So not quite the first time, but still, I don't know. Always a really fun topic for people, I think.
Yeah, like there's a big like a lot of people are really into like lost video games, unreleased, lost media.
I don't know anything about that.
Yeah. And like you brought up, a good one you brought up was Raven Simone's podcast about the Mean Girls video game. Was that what that
was
about?
Yeah, Mean Girls. That was Mean Girls.
Yeah. And like stuff like what I write about and what like people like Raven write about are about releasing unreleased games, but also it's about context. Mm-hmm. Because like I think you put it really good once, Frank. I think you said like, game exists is a story that we hear every single week, and that's not interesting. What's interesting is, why should we care about this game? What's the story behind it? Why did it get canceled? Who worked on it? Do they still have copies? I think, like, it's so easy to just, like, find an unreleased game and just dump it on the internet, which is good. Like, I like when people do that, but
hang on. First
awesome.
Of all, it's not so easy to find an unreleased video game. That is a skill that the two of you especially have been accumulating for many years. So don't sell yourself short on that. But I like the thread you're going with, so continue.
Yeah, but there's a lot of, I guess I'll say, like, there's a lot of good, specialized, talented people that are putting unreleased games on the internet. But there are people who will just, like, take the file, put it onto the internet, which is awesome, but, like, I don't know the context. I don't know if I should actually care about this. Mm-hmm. And I think a good article with context can get shared around and encourages people to consider the historical value of their work. And that's we're trying to do over at Gaming Alexandria.
Yeah, I hear you and agree. And it's, you know, I think we might have similar origin stories in that, like, that's what led me down this path of being an archivist for video games is that I was frustrated by the scenario that you're describing, which is that unreleased video games would just be put on the internet without any context behind them. And at that point, it's like, it's just kind of like a crappy game that you might find if you're channel surfing through a set of ROMs for a system and that's it. And video games ultimately are, like anything else, human stories, right? And yeah. It's like, well, yeah, like, no, they weren't trying to make a crappy game that didn't come out. They were trying to make a product. And in a lot of cases, there's real heart put into this stuff, and you're not going to know that by just playing it.
Yeah, and like, it should be like, what's way more interesting than seeing a crappy game is knowing, why is it crappy? What was the development like? Who worked on it? What did anything get in the way that made it that way? Is what we have online finished?
Right. Yeah. And well, I mean, I guess that could lead us right into talking about this game. I mean, what led you to the Sacred Pools?
Okay. So this is the funny thing about how I found this game was that I found it by complete accident. So this was something that I knew existed. There's a couple articles on it online. You can see like Unseen 64 and whatever. But like, we really didn't know anything about this game. And like, the few articles online are just like, this was an unreleased Sega Saturn game. It was made for adults. And it contained hardcore nudity and violence. Which, when we see the game, that's actually not true, but that's aside the point. Fast forward to, I guess, end of 2021. I see a tweet. I'm going through my Twitter, and I see this post from a guy. His name is Joe's Rare Stuff, and I'll probably link his account. But the guy who ran this account, his name was Joseph Kane, and Joe was a tester at Sega, and he worked on a ton of games in the early and mid 90s. I think he has his name on like Sonic Spinball. He worked on Echo the Dolphin. He worked on the original Virtual Fighter. He later worked on the Atari. He worked on some Atari Jaguar stuff. Lots of stuff, lots of stories. And like, not only is he like a game developer, but he's like a hardcore collector. And he has like a lot of rare stuff. And he would post on this account like, hey, I have this prototype. I have this document. And he makes this post for like some honestly not interesting game. It was like a soccer game for the Game Gear. And he's like, hey, can anyone help me dump this? So I reach out and be like, hey, I work for this website. I can help you get this online. And we get talking, and he just keeps telling me about all the stuff he has. And then in the middle of his conversation, he just goes, oh, hey, my friend David, ever heard the Sacred Pools? I'm like, I've heard of that, yeah. Oh yeah, he has
I just want to clarify. Sure, my internal database has this game that we know like half a sentence about. Yes.
Yes, yes. But yeah, so he mentions that. This is an aside. I'm like, oh, okay, that's cool. And then I completely forget about that for like 3 months. And then like later, I'm on a plane. And I'm about to check my phone before we lift off, and my phone opens up, and it's another message from Joe. He's like, oh, hey, by the way, I'm talking to David. Hey, do you want to send... He wants to release all his Sacred Pool stuff. And I'm like, okay, awesome. And what I thought at first he just had a single prototype, maybe like an early build. No, he had the complete alpha builds for Sega Saturn, PC, Macintosh, and Sony PlayStation. So he had all, like, every single final version of the game ready, and he wanted to get it released. So, by complete accident, I found, like, the mother load of Sacred Pools.
So, let's talk about the game, then. So the game was made by SegaSoft, which is a division that I kind of vaguely remembered from just being around, but, I mean, what was SegaSoft?
Well, SegaSoft kind of came about in a really weird time for Sega, which was the release of the Sega Saturn, because that got prematurely released at E3. There was, like, no units, there was no games, like, there was executive infighting. It was just a really bad time for the company. And like Isao Okawa, who was a chairman at Sega, he thought like maybe the problem is that we're doing consoles. I think the future is home computers. So Sega starts talking, and they say Sega of America opens a division in California for SegaSoft. They get a bunch of ex-producers to come and work in there, and they really had like full reign to do whatever they wanted, if that makes sense.
Because this is stuff that's not just being produced for Sega systems, right? Like, this is for computers, for PlayStation. This is, they can kind of start, not competing with themselves per se, but like, they can start doing stuff that doesn't have to be on this dying Saturn system.
Yeah. So, like, they had a lot more freedom as an independent branch. So, like, games could be, like, cross-platform, like you said. Like, Sega could develop games on the PlayStation, or, and, like, they didn't have to focus on the children. They could focus on, like, make games for the adults, which is how stuff like Sacred Pools came in.
Okay, well, let's talk about the game, then. I mean, you kind of mentioned briefly that, well, you mentioned the line that we knew online, right? Which is it's a game with hardcore nudity and violence, and it was just for adults. And so you receive the game, and I assume you play it. What kind of game are we talking about here?
Okay, so, well, what we don't have is hardcore nudity, excessive violence, or whatever. You start the game off, and it's sort of just, you're just in a maze. It's hard to describe, because we still don't really know how to play this game. It's just, you first cutscene you see, you're just standing in front of a door. You walk through that door, and then you walk down a hallway, and then you see another door. And you open that door, and then you get some code. So you walk back, and then you put the code in. Like, it's very basic, and but it's also very complicated, because we don't know how we're supposed to play this game. It's very vague.
Is it finished? It's finished, just not very, like...
It's finished, yes.
Just not very clear what to do?
Absolutely not, and that's kind of the point.
Well, I mean, it kind of sounds like... And this, I believe this is literally true, but you can color this in for me. It sounds like that era of mid-90s sort of... like CD-ROM multimedia kind of game where it's kind of made more by video people than Hollywood. Made more by like Hollywood video sort of people than actual game developers.
Yes. Like most of the staff that was working on it, like other than like producers at Sega of America and like there was a company in the UK that just like filled in all the programming and stuff. Other than those people, the entire staff was just, like, people working in Hollywood. Like, we talk about in the article, we just list some of the people that worked on the game, and it's like, none of them have any experience working in video games. Like, you got people who worked on, like, I don't know, like, The X-Files, or, like, a guy who got to start directing on, like, Gilligan's Island. Like, no one who's ever touched a video game in their life are now making a video game for Sega.
So you have, like, impressive resumes for the wrong... industry, basically, well, which is pretty similar to how I feel a lot of FMV stuff goes. But this is pretty late for a big budget FMV game, right? I mean, they showed this off in 1996. So, I mean, what is the state of full motion video games in 1996? Like, are people even still playing them?
No, people are very sick of FMV games because you just read like. I went through a lot of old magazines that kind of reviewed this game, and, like, barely any talk about what it's actually like. They're just like, oh, it's another FMV game. Whoa, ooh, cool. Look at all the special effects. Boring. Give me another 3D platformer. Because, like, I think the peak of FMV games was, like, the early 90s with, like, the CDI and the Sega CD and the 3DO. I think by 1997, people kind of stop caring about FMV games.
Yeah, it's what this conversation is sort of reminding me of, Kelsey, is the episode that we did with Jimmy Maher about Toonstruck, about how, like,
right,
you know what I mean, where like 1997 sort of like the culmination of that sort of Hollywood convergence and everyone just sort of abandoning that notion of this being the future of games all at once.
But this game had a really big budget, right? So I mean that's exactly. Sort of that's
if you look at the game, it looks very expensive.
Which is so funny because it also
doesn't look
like,
good, but it looks expensive.
It doesn't look good. It looks expensive. That's
which was most of SegaSoft's games, to be honest. Like they look like you can tell a lot of money went into it, but then like I don't know how familiar you are with, like SegaSoft's other games. Have you ever played them?
I don't believe I have, but I was looking around as we were talking and just, you know, for the sake of listeners, you know, a typical product would be something like Cosmopolitan Virtual Makeover on the PC, right? Where it's, you know, sort of a game, but it's more of a computer multimedia thing. It looks like they were also responsible for Heat.net, which was Sega's online service, right?
Probably the most famous thing they did. They also did... Mr. Bones for the Sega Saturn. Have you ever played that game?
Oh, I'm familiar.
Oh my god,
I played it.
Yeah. That game is the definition of looks bad but very expensive.
No one's played Mr. Bones. They just make fun of it.
Yeah, there's a very funny video from when SegaSoft first started. That's like when they're talking about like we're an independent branch. We can make games to reach all customers. We're not going to focus on children. We're going to make games for adults. And as they're saying this, they're playing like Mr. Bones footage of like a skeleton dancing around.
Well, I mean, on that note, there's not the hardcore nudity that someone on the internet promised, but this game does sort of have I use the word loosely, mature themes. Am I right?
Yeah, I guess.
The costumes are small.
The costumes. we have a there's a photo in the article of one of the actors from behind the scenes, and it's like, okay, that is edging on nudity, so
it's risque.
But
I actually was, something you mentioned in the article that I actually didn't realize is, because the Saturn in Japan had hentai games. Like it had games that had full nudity in it. That was not something that, I mean, it didn't happen over here, but in Japan that was, you know, there were completely like X-rated Saturn games. I didn't realize that in 1996 they stopped that. Like they announced that they were not going to do that anymore. So I'm it's an interesting kind of confluence of like right as Sega is saying, okay, we're not going to have any more nudity on the Saturn, that there's this game that comes along that's like, yeah, but we're going to right now start to do the adult theme ones in
the US. We're
going
to get as close as possible to, we can't be naked, but we can get kind of naked.
I don't fault them or anyone for trying to go for this kind of product in this time. Because it was sort of this exciting, like, technological leap that's happening. And it does seem like, you know, it's coming right on the heels of the video game industry sort of graduating into being its own thing, you know, around like 95 when E3 starting and everything. And you know, there was a lot of excitement about pushing the industry forward and trying to figure out, like, what is the future of what we're doing here? And how do we graduate this past being a pastime for kids. So for Sega of America, especially, to sort of form a division and go all in on multimedia and, you know, thing like, again, I think Cosmopolitan Virtual Makeover is a really good example of the ethos of the time, right? Like Sega's making, a barely video game interactive experience about, about makeup and hair makeovers and stuff like that. And it's like, you know, it makes sense to me that a company at this time would be exploring that avenue before sort of all of it became normalized again into more traditional video games.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So they work on this game. They actually, it is announced. That's why we knew about it. So what was its public presence like?
Barely non-existent, to be honest, because the game made one appearance at E3, which I'll get into. But before that, there was just a couple of announcements, mostly in, like, European magazines, like England and Germany. They talked a lot about this game. I don't think any of the main magazines in, like, in the U.S. really talked about it, because they were kind of over FMV games at that point.
I'm surprised it didn't get covered just to, like, be made fun of, though. Yeah, that feels like the kind of thing U.S. magazines would be doing at the time.
Well, the Europeans, they made fun of this game mercilessly.
And like, okay, someone's doing it.
Yeah, you look at, oh my god, you look at British game journalism in the 90s, it's so funny. Like, you know, like the way they talk about, like, Sacred Pools is just like, it's like Doctor Who on crack. Who made this game? Were they on drugs?
That's what they have to compare it to over there.
Yeah, that's all they have. They bring it to E3, and this is something we knew about the game also, based on, like, a few tweets of people who were there. But May of 1996, Sega held this massive party for the Sacred Pools. And, like, SegaSoft always kind of did a bunch of, like, quirky and big marketing stuff. But for this, they kind of went all out. So at E3, there was this big booth for the Sacred Pools, just playing, like, a video of the opening cutscene on a loop. And there was people standing up front. Oh, this anyone that walked by and checked the game out, they would get a little marble. And they're like, what's this marble for? Oh, it's a ticket. So after the E3 show, you could bring a marble up to a gate, and then you could be invited into the press party for Sacred Pools. They had, like, actors speaking in fake languages. They had performers swinging in the air. If you guys are familiar with the band Hole,
sure.
They played a show there. It was a VIP lounge. There was actresses from the games giving out autographs.
This is just the most, like, 90s E3 party I have ever heard.
There's stories of, like, people who were there and just like, oh, I had one ticket and I invited 20 people. Sega did not care.
It's 90s, sure, but I think it's more Hollywood. Like, this is, you know what I mean? Like, this is true. Is just, it's not video games. They're putting on their big boy pants, pretending that they're, like, the real entertainment industry.
Yeah, but I mean, like, even Nintendo threw parties like that. Maybe not the people speaking in fake languages, but the having a really major music act.
They didn't have Courtney Love on stage singing Miss World or whatever. But
they didn't have Courtney Love, but they had, like, what, Seal? And I don't know.
What did they have Seal?
Seal's a little more wholesome than Courtney Love.
I did not know that.
Are you, like, do you actually know that Nintendo had a party with Seal?
I am almost positive. I have to look.
Wait,
okay. Pause the podcast.
Stop the podcast. Dig the archives.
Did people play Donkey Kong Country while he sang Kissed by a Rose?
A very funny thing I found out about this E3 party was one of the attendees there was Jeff Keighley of the Game Awards. He was 18 at the time, I think.
Aww.
This comes from IGN's 1995 E3 coverage, is that Seal performed at the Nintendo party. So,
IGN was around in 95?
Were they? Maybe they weren't. Well, okay, this is... I'm not gonna do investigative journalism live on this show, but there are two journalists who at least say that this happened.
Okay.
I would like to see a video of that, though. That would be fun.
I did not know that.
Okay, so they had a big E3 splash. They had a big party. They really tried to push this thing. There was some press coverage after the fact, I believe, but maybe not very positive.
No, not much. really what the press had to say was like, oh yeah, party was cool, but the game still sucks. And even people internally at Sega, like the testers, like they also thought it wasn't very good.
So is that about as far as the game got? They put something together for E3 and then kind of quietly, you know, realized that, like, this isn't coming together, and they killed it? Or what became of the game?
I don't know what really happened after E3, because the build we have, like, what they showed at E3 was just, like, a demo you couldn't even play. It was just a bunch of cutscenes back-to-back There was no control or anything. You could just watch, be like, this is what our game's going to look like. But what we have is a fully, fairly finished game, at least for the Sega Saturn. So I don't know when they, how long they continued after E3, like when it finished. I think it was canceled like mid-1997, if I were to guess.
And it's basically just, I mean, you spoke to some people involved with this game, right? I mean, do they have any ideas about kind of, I mean, we'll back up after this too, but do they have any ideas of kind of like why it was canceled? Obviously, internally, people aren't liking it. Externally, people aren't liking it. Seems fairly cut and dry, but I mean, did anyone you speak to give a reason?
Nothing really more than that. What I have heard was just like, Joe Miller, who was like one of the heads at SegaSoft, he worked for Sega of America. He like pushed hard for this game until it actually started coming together. And he was like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to be. I thought this was going to be this grand FMV adventure. And then when he actually starts seeing the game, it's just like, well, you're just walking back and forth through doors, doing puzzles that don't make any sense. So I think once the people who were making this game realized what their game was going to actually be, they kind of stopped caring and then decided to cancel the project, which is a shame because like a lot of talent and a lot of effort and a lot of heart went into this game. I know it's not the best game in the world. It's far from it, but like you can tell a lot of work went into it.
You did mention one kind of interesting thing about this game or a thing that makes it, I don't know, stand out a little bit from other FMV games, which is that VNRS technology. Can you talk a little bit about what that is?
VNRS technology is virtual navigation in real space, which allows seamless 3D environment and FMV environments. I am reading that straight from the article I wrote because I don't know anything about this. When you look this up on Google, there are zero results. I say this in the article, but there's a chance that Sega might have just made that up.
They made that up. That's blast processing. That's all that is.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, but it is something that you mentioned, like in the article. It does feel a little different in that the camera seems to move with you as you move around, which is a little uncommon for an FMV game at the time, because it's typically kind of like static shots where I don't know if I'm explaining this well, but it's like, there's something there, right? There's something that makes it a little
like,
bit
I guess what you mean is like, if like in most FMV games, if you're standing somewhere, there's like four screens where it's like front of you, behind you, left of you, right of you. But for Sacred Pools, it's just like a full 360 degrees you can turn around, which is impressive, but I don't know if that's the first game to do it, if it's the only game to do it.
Sure.
Like, VNRS probably isn't a real thing. I assume that's a lie.
It's better than Myst. That's all better we're getting at.
Yeah.
Better than Myst. Oh, Myst well, with tell VRRS. Us a little bit.
Tell us a little bit about the people that you talked to about this game. Like, what were you able to learn from, I don't know, anything fun from talking to some of the people who were involved with this?
I was not able to track down, like, there's three main people who worked on this game, which are Joe Miller, the producer, who is no longer with us. He passed away in 2014. There is Chris Bankston, who was the producer behind the film production. He's only done like one interview. He doesn't really talk about his game career. And the third guy is a guy named James Riley, who I'd like to talk about for a little bit. Are you guys familiar with James Riley at all?
I can't say that I am, no.
Okay, because I'm not sure how classified James Riley. James Riley is like the... He is the Steven Spielberg of FMV games.
Okay.
Because he is most famously the director and co-creator of Night Trap. And then after that, he made Double Switch, he made Sewer Shark, He made a game when he was working for Sega Studios, which was the company that filmed Sacred Pools. He did a couple games there. He did Surgical Strike. He did a game called Wirehead, which is very interesting. Pretty much any main Sega FMV games probably have James Riley's name somewhere in the credits.
Well, and he goes back to the Nemo, right, with Hasbro. Like, he is kind of at the start of this attempt at FMV.
Yes. Yeah. Nemo is a completely different story. I think that's been told plenty of times, but basically that was I don't know how to describe it. It was like a videotape system for Hasbro that would have been one of the first systems to make like a live action movie game where you could film a bunch of stuff. You could just hit a button to go to the next scene, walk around. Like an early example of FMV games from like 1986.
And a lot of the kind of big ones that they were working on over there for the Nemo did end up like they got the rights to it when that folded. And yeah. That's how we have Sewer Shark and Night Trap and all that.
Yeah, Night Trap was originally a Nemo game that James Riley wrote and directed. So, James Riley is working for Digital Pictures for a very long time. He makes a couple of games there, and Digital Pictures has such a success making FMV games for Sega. But they also have a ton of different visions. So, Sega's like, well, why don't we just make our own FMV company? So, Chris Bankston, who was working at Sega of America, decides to open a studio in Beverly Hills called Sega Studios. And they did a couple of games there. They did Wirehead, as I talked about. They did Surgical Strike. And they decided to pick up James Riley from Digital Pictures to work with them. At Sega Studios, Riley and Bankston worked with like 500 production members. As I said earlier, they got like a ton of people who were all over Hollywood, none of which really played a video game before or worked on a video game. But aside from James Riley, pretty much nobody on the staff really worked on video games. Riley was like the only guy that kind of knew how it worked. He had experience working in both film and video games, so he kind of knew how to combine both of them to make a game.
So is this someone were you able to talk to him, or was this one of the people you weren't able to get a hold of?
I was not able to talk to him, no.
Oh, okay.
Well, I actually don't know what became of him after the FMV game boom. Did he stay with games?
He left video game. Like, Sacred Pools was the last video game he ever did. Aside from that, he's just been doing like visual effects for random TV shows.
Wait, was he like the director of Night Trap?
He was the director of Night Trap.
So this is the final game from the Spielberg of FMV games.
Yes.
That's a pretty big deal.
It actually is. You know, yeah. Like that's.
That's a good hook.
It really is. Like, to me, like when I'm sort of looking at Lost Media and, you know, when we're sort of planning, like, should we put effort into acquiring this game, into like creating content around this game? It's like what tends to make us sign off on it is this work by someone notable? You know what I mean? Like, yeah. does this help fill in the biography of a person or people who made product that we know will resonate with people? And if so, then it's probably worth it. And so, you know, to know that this is sort of the swan song of, you know, who is probably the most notable. I mean, we're kind of joking about the Spielberg or whatever, but it's like, he probably is the most notable FMV game director. I mean, period.
I can't name any other FMV director.
Right.
I know you guys can.
So to sort of see like the final product from him and get a sense of, you know, what it was going to be, like, I think it's fascinating. And to hear that it's sort of a game design mess makes it even more fascinating to me.
Yeah. I mean, like, Night Trap and Sacred Pools are kind of like, they're close. I talk about this in the article, trying to relate them to, but they're both like, they're slightly risque. They're not games for adults, but like, well, we're getting away with some stuff. Like, it's, they're very ambitious, they're very corny, but, and the press was kind of so-so about it. Like, game, like, plot-wise, they're very, very different. Like, Night Trap takes place at, like, a slumber party. Sacred Pools takes place in, like, outer space.
Outer space slumber party.
Yeah, outer space slumber party. outer space pool party.
God, is there anything else left to say about this game? I mean, you know, like, I think it's a really, I'm really glad that you stumbled into it. I'm glad that, you know, we sort of can fill out, like I said, the biography of this guy and indeed the rest of the staff of SegaSoft, because I think that's in itself a really interesting slice of video game history, was this time where everyone, including Sega, was trying to go Hollywood. You know, beyond that, is there, to you personally, Dylan, sort of a legacy we should be thinking about when it comes to this game or the team that made it?
I do think Sacred Pools does have an important piece in Sega history, as it's a part of their SegaSoft division, which was super short-lived, but was super ambitious and always trying to make new stuff, make games for adults, make Sega games for the PlayStation. They had, like, and it was only existed for, like 5 years. So it's just a very rare glimpse at a period of Sega that doesn't really exist anymore. And as we talk about with, like, James Riley, a lot of really talented people, industry legends, I would say, worked on this game. So it's very interesting to see some lost work.
Cool. So, you know, before we wrap up, let's talk about you for a minute. I mean, how did you get involved with sort of, I don't know what the term for it, you know, like hunting, you know what I mean? Hunting, like how did you get involved in video game archaeology?
I guess I should say, people listening to this podcast have probably noticed this, but I'm young. I'm a younger guy, but I first got into, like, I guess in general, video game preservation when I was at my cousin's place and he was showing me how to download emulators and stuff. I'm like, oh, that's really cool. So, like, for a period, I got super into emulation. I learned, like, oh, when something is labeled as this, that's an unreleased game. When something's labeled like this, is a game from Japan. So, like, and I got deeper and deeper into that. Around, like, 2020, 2019, I discovered the guys starting over at Gaming Alexandria, which I know you guys are big fans of.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I just decided to be like, hey, I can help write for you guys. So I wrote a couple articles, because working for Gaming Alexandria, I'm able to reach out to people, be like, hey, I work for a game preservation group. We really care about your work, and we want to save this stuff. This stuff's super important. And we don't want to, as I talked about at the start of this podcast, we want to do more than just dump a file online. There's an interesting story here, and I do think it deserves to be told.
This is very similar to the Frank Cifaldi origin story, which is very, very fun for me to listen to.
Well, I'm little Frank.
Well, and you're going to end up having done this for longer than anyone in history, because you're getting a younger start than anyone else has. So by the time we're all old and dead, you'll be the reigning king.
Well, I gotta save your guys' stories, first of all.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, make Frank care about himself.
Well, it's like...
Be at Frank's deathbed, being like, please, give me the keys to the foundation.
I mean, this might be... No, I don't think there's getting too personal with this stuff here. Like, when I turned 40 this year, the first, like, half of the day was maybe the first time I felt old. Like, ever. It's just like, oh, this number feels very old. I am officially old. But by the second half of the day, and I should expand on that. It's not just I'm old. It was like, I don't have that much time left to do my work, because, like, that's what I care about, is doing my work. It's like, how much more can I accomplish in the next 20 years? That sucks. But then as the day progressed, I was like, no, actually, I've been doing my work since I was 18, and I'm going to do it till I'm dead. And, like, you can't get better than that.
That's like, kind of the maximum amount of time you can do it, unless you're Dylan.
Unless you're Dylan, and you start at, what, like 16, 15, something like that? So you are going...
16. I started at 16.
So if you live more years than me, you will be the reigning king.
Unless I live 2 years older than you, then we're either equal. Maybe I can beat you. I accept your challenge, Frank.
Okay, so the challenge now is to outlive each other. Let's go.
Okay. I'm not the only younger person that's into this.
No, not at all. We had the Brickster on the show, who I think is a similar age to you as well.
Yeah, and you check out people like there's like the what's it called like the Lost Media Wiki, and like that's all like people that's like people that like I look at. I'm like, oh my god, you're young and you're doing this work. Wow. That guy's 13.
On that note, like, I'm not, it's not, I don't mean this in any offensive way, but I think it's just because I lived it myself. It's not interesting to me that you're young and interesting, right? But what's interesting to me is that you're this age and you're into stuff that old. Yeah. Is there a reason for that?
I mean, I guess in the current climate we live in where it's like everything from the 80s and 90s is coming back, like everyone my age is like, well, yeah. Okay, it's the 80s, it's the 90s. We know all that stuff. Because, like, I think we, like, kids, I guess, like, younger people of 2020 know more about the past than I think people of the 1990s know about the past. I'm trying to say that in a way that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. That makes sense. Like, when I was your age in the 90s, you know, the 70s were something that none of us cared about. Remotely, and we didn't have the internet to go find out why it was interesting, you know.
Yeah,
it was
the
old crap in grandma's house is from the 70s and it's very brown and wooden and I don't like it.
Yeah, because like when I was a kid just watching when I was younger and I was watching YouTube videos, it was just like, wow, I like learning about these old Nintendo games that were made 30 years before I was born, and now I'm the one telling that to people that are going to be writing about that in the future.
And for what it's worth, Frank, just someone who, you know, runs a game store, I very often see, I don't know about very often, but like, I absolutely see kids who come in and, you know, it'll be a 10-year-old explaining to their father who Gunpei Yokoi was and pointing at a Game Boy and stuff. So, I mean, it's a...
Do you violently correct him? At the...
No.
It wasn't a janitor, you dumb what? Kid.
I've never heard a kid say that, but okay. I might correct a kid.
I believe
if, so what, if a kid does say that, what are you going to do? Go slap.
Are they talking to me? Am I like how it depends on how in earshot I am and how much I'm meant to be involved in this conversation.
They're telling it to their father and you just overhear it as you're like stalking a shelf or something. What do you do?
It's a child. I'm not going to correct a child. I will correct someone. Well, I don't know. I don't like correcting people.
You like educating though. I think you're going to do it.
Okay. I like telling people the right version of the story, but okay. I also don't like to be the person who comes in and goes, well, actually, so.
I disagree. You do like being that person.
Come on, Kelsey.
I don't like that I like that. How about that? Is that
okay,
better?
That's fair. That's fair. But you do like doing it. Dylan, thank you again so much for joining us on the Video Game History Hour. Everyone, check out Dylan's article on the Sacred Pools on the Gaming Alexandria website. We will link to that in the show notes. And then for those listening, Dylan, where can people keep up with you on the internet?
As you said, yeah, you can check me out over at gamingalexandria.com. I mostly focus on writing about like prototypes and dumps, but we have an open Discord for a ton of historians. We do a lot about scanning, we do a lot about interviews. We got like a great staff, we got a great Discord server with like over 1,000 people sharing their work, sharing information. And other than that, me personally, you can find me on That Dylan Fellow on Twitter. And also, I started writing for, I've done some work for Did You Know Gaming, if you want to check that out. I'm sure people listening to this know that site, so.
So recommend, just pick one video you worked on that's your favorite at Did You Know Gaming.
I did one for, in working with Gaming Alexandria, we released an unreleased Nintendo DS game for called A Boy and His Blob, which was a port of the old Nintendo Entertainment System game. So we collaborated, we did a video talking about, like, what happened, why that game was canceled, and let's release the ROM. So it was kind of nice to get it out in both article form and video form. So that was a really fun project you could check out.
Cool. Go check that out. Actually, that is not a port of the Nintendo game. The Nintendo game is kind of interesting. This DS game is kind of nothing. It's kind of a nothing game. Sorry to people who made it. You made kind of a nothing game.
Yeah, it's an okay game. It's like, what, like 10% complete? It's like,
sure, sure. It's if you want to pretend really hard, you can see a game there. But it is
one. Wow.
If you squint really hard, it's a finished
game. I think the original is very interesting. I don't think it's good. I think it's really interesting.
I like the original.
And this game, I don't think understood the heart of it remotely. But I don't know why I'm just talking smack about this game right now, but
yeah. Where's this coming from?
Let's end this show.
Okay,
talking smack about a 10% complete prototype themselves was bad and did not.
It should
finish.
Be 100% complete at 10%. I don't understand.
All right, thanks again, Dylan.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Video Game History Hour, brought to you by the Video Game History Foundation. If you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Twitter at Game History Hour or email us at podcast@gamehistory.org. Did you know that the Video Game History Foundation is a 501c3 nonprofit and that all of your contributions are tax deductible? You can support this podcast and all of our other work on Patreon or at gamehistory.org/donate. This episode of the Video Game History Hour was produced by Robin Kunimune and edited by Michael Carroll. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.